We have the minutes on our agenda. We have established a quorum. We have a minute, our minutes on our agenda. Senator, would you look them over for a moment, please? Are there any corrections to the minutes?
I'll also move, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves approval of the minutes. Discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The first bill on our agenda today is Senate File 1098, Senator Skoy. Senator Larson moves adoption of the committee report, subcommittee report on elections for Senate File 1098. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The subcommittee report is adopted. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm before you with Senate File 1098. This is a provision that would allow the Beltrami County Recorder to be appointed as opposed to elected. This is a request that comes to me from the Beltrami County Board. It does have the provisions that would bring this to a referendum by petition if 10% of the residents petition for a vote.
Are there questions for Senator Skoy about Senate File 1098? This, once again, is one of those individual bills that is for a process by which to change an elected official to an appointed one. It was Senator Mary Olson who had a bill that would allow this statewide without individual counties having to come before the legislature for special legislation. Any questions for Senator Skoy? Comments? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or opposition of this bill?
Can I just
double check?
The language looks quite similar, to bills that we've had in the past, if not identical. I assume that everything in this in here is what we all already done.
Senator Skoy, is this boilerplate language?
Mr. Chair, I believe the only change from what's currently in law is that it's Beltrami County as opposed to other jurisdictions.
Okay. Are there any other questions? And Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 1098 be recommended pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very
Madam
much,
Chair
Senator
members.
Skoy. Senator Torres Ray here. Senator Erickson Ropes. Senator Saxhawk. Senator Chaudhry. We're getting close, Senator Olsen. Senator Olsen. Number 8 on the agenda.
Madam Chair and members, I'm here before you today on Senate File 1350. And this is a bill relating to elections. And it came out over a recent school board election in St. Francis.
Senator Olsen, was this bill heard in the election subcommittee?
Yes, it was.
First of all, then, Senator Larson moves adoption of the Senate of the subcommittee report, Subcommittee on Elections report on Senate File 13. The members have that. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Now, Senator Olsen, 1350 is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A concern was raised that in the November election, the school referendum, there were like 4 bonds and questions and 2 failed. And somebody read in the law that it says they only needed 50 voters or 5% of the number of voters. So somebody did their homework and found out that they could actually hold an election. So the simple fix to this is that we've added 3 words, whichever is greater, the 50 voters or the 5% of numbers from the last or regular or preceding regular school board election. So that's what we're before you with today.
Are there questions for Senator Olsen? Members at Senator Loring.
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Olsen, was this the initial intent of the legislation? This is just bringing
clarifying what the original intent was?
Senator Rolstein.
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, I believe that the discussion in the subcommittee on elections was that when these revisions were updated, somebody left something out. And so it doesn't make any sense to say 50 or 5%. So we think we're just bringing this back to the original intent.
Members, I regard this as a fairly technical correction, and I wonder if we might have a motion to put it on the consent calendar. Senator Lurie.
So moved that Senate file 276.
1350.
Be recommended to pass and put on the consent calendar.
Senator Lurie moves that Senate file 1350 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor of that motion? Or first of all, is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate file 1350? Seeing none, we have Senator Lurie's motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to present Senate file 1651.
Senator Torres-Ray, this was also a bill heard in the subcommittee on elections.
Madam Chair.
Senator Larson.
Madam Chair, I'd move adoption of the Subcommittee on Elections report on Senate File 1651.
Senator Larson moves adoption of the committee subcommittee report on elections for 1651. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. We now have Senate File 1651. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair, again, and thank you, members of the committee. Senate File 1651, with your support, will put in place a system for translation of voting materials into languages other than English. And I have Mr. Cooper with me today who will help me present the technicalities of this bill and respond to some of the questions about what materials are going to be translated and what to what purposes, and also how the actual structure will work. But I was invited to do this, and I am delighted to be here before the committee because I wanted to share my own experience with these issues. As you know, being the first Latina elected to the Senate gave me the opportunity to do a lot of door knocking and visiting homes of people that traditionally do not participate in the voting process. And it generated a lot of attention in communities that new immigrant communities, and people knew about my name and knew who I was. And I decided to go door knock places that are not traditionally door knocked by candidates. And when people came to the door, I noticed that many immigrant elderly people were very excited about the opportunity to vote, but they really didn't understand the process very well. And it was, I think, really, for me, an important lesson, because I thought that by the time people decide to vote for a person, they understood the process. But many people, when they opened the door, sometimes they said to me, well, you know, thank you for coming, Senator, but I already committed to vote for somebody else who is running for the Senate. And I think her name was Amy, or they named somebody else. And I said, well, you know, they are running for office in for U.S. office, and I'm running for state Senate. Oh, they said, so there are two Senates. Yes, there are two Senates. And then I had to explain what it was. So I ended up using a lot of time, you know, during my campaign to really let people know about how the process works. And I think that the language was a significant barrier. And I just hope that this is particularly an issue for older people who came to this country as refugees or came here under asylum, and they are now citizens, but they don't have, they are not fluent in the language. And this process, I think, is even difficult for people who speak the language. They sometimes they don't understand. But having this information available in the language could help us facilitate this conversation and really let people know about, you know, this this wonderful democracy and the importance of participating in the voting process. So that's the reason I'm here, to ask for your support, and I'm going to let Mr. Cooper talk about the materials that we are talking about today and the process. So, Mr. Cooper, if you could identify yourself.
Mr. Cooper, we did have an extensive hearing on this in elections, so if you could be very brief, that would be appreciated.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Cooper. I'm here representing the Minnesota Voting Rights Coalition. Our interest in this issue is that many of the participants in our coalition go out and do nonpartisan voter registration, voter mobilization drives to get people to participate in civic life in Minnesota. And one of the communities that many of our organizations outreach to is the new Minnesotans, the new citizens who live in Minnesota, who may come from places where English is not their native language, and who therefore face an additional barrier to all the other ones that all of your other constituents face. Obviously, people have to understand kind of how elections work and how you can register and where you go and vote. And we all deal with that all the time when we're trying to get people involved in elections. But folks who may feel most comfortable and be most fluent in another language than English face the additional barrier of maybe not feeling like complicated things like voter registration applications and absentee ballot forms are really easy for them to understand. And, of course, we're asking them to swear an oath on those applications. And so having them understand carefully what it is that they are attesting to is very important, we feel. This would allow them to be able to see materials in the language they feel most comfortable in, those materials being the voter registration application, the absentee ballot application, and the absentee ballot itself. And we think that this is a common sense thing to do. We know that many nonprofits, many governmental organizations, counties and cities, and many campaigns and parties produce materials in languages other than English when trying to reach out to citizens who might have a native language other than English. One additional piece that I would like to point out is in Section 1, there would be a poster produced that would have the language on it. Voter registration applications and ballot instructions are available in blank language, and that would be in a variety of languages posted up at the polling place so someone could go to it and indicate what language they speak. This is a great idea. I recently saw a poster like this actually in a Lowe's in Owatonna. I was down there shopping at Lowe's with my mother-in-law, and this was by the customer service desk, and it actually had 140 languages on it and said, if you point to the language, our customer service people will get someone on the phone who speaks your language and can translate for you. We thought that was a great idea, and we think it would be very helpful in the polling place.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. I just will point out to members that right now the state demographer makes a report to the Secretary of State about languages other than English that are common, so that there would be a need for voting materials. And one of those languages used to be German. And now there's not a significant German-only speaking population that there would be a need for that. So there, the state demographer makes a report to the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State develops the materials, and then the county auditors determine which of their precincts and areas, neighborhoods, they need those materials for. I think it's a pretty good process. I appreciate Senator Torres Ray, you're bringing this forward. Comments or questions for either the witness or Senator Torres Ray? Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Torres Ray, the bill says that counties in which the county auditor has determined a need for non-English voting materials must provide a poster. There's no threshold stated. So if there's, say, one family that speaks Russian, as an example, do they have to make an accommodation there with a poster? There's probably hundreds of different languages that are spoken through the state. Mr. Cooper just talked about a poster. He said, well, Owatonna, wouldn't it make some sense to just have some generic posters printed that every county could use, whether or not you know of any language spoken there. I'm trying to figure out how do you make it work when you don't know exactly every language you're going to be facing within every county or every precinct, but we know statewide there's numerous. And how do you get there to make this work?
Senator Bessel, I would draw your attention to the second section of the bill, there is discretion there, but where the county auditor determines the materials that would be necessary, and that need, again, it's not specified particularly, but is determined based upon an assessment of the likely voting population in each precinct. Do you think there needs to be a higher standard than that?
Well, my point, Madam Chair, is that you may have one individual who happens to, be bilingual but speaks one particular language. Do you have to make accommodation for that one person and that one person's family, or if it's 10 people? The county auditor may not know. So do you have to be prepared for each one of the languages that we think is spoken within the state? I don't know. As the county auditor goes forward, obviously you have some large groups. It's fairly easy to figure, we've got a large Somali presence in a certain city, so we should be prepared for that. But there just may be some people we didn't include, and is that the intent, that if it's too small, we skip them over, which doesn't seem fair either? I don't know. Again, when you get these small little groups, how are they going to be dealt with?
Senator Torres Ray.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I think that gradually, by kind of improving the practice, we will deal with some of these issues as Madam Chair just eloquently presented. We have, through time, the need for some languages may not even be there. Then we have to transition into other languages. And I think that we need to leave this decision to the local authorities to define this and to determine kind of the likely voting population in the precinct, because I think that is really the only way we can do this. Ideally, I think we should be able to accommodate every language, but I don't think that is practical. But I don't think that should be determined here, because I think it's just too complicated. We have a state that has a large influx of immigrants from many parts of the world, and I think it will be difficult for us to come up with an idea here that could work at the local level. So I think the language in here that stipulates that the need for materials must be determined based upon an assessment of the likely voting population in each precinct is the way we should start. I don't know if that responds to your question, Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, as you can see from the old language here on page 2, this is not a new requirement. There has been this requirement for translated materials for some time now. And language similar to Senate File 1651 was considered by the Elections Committee within the last couple of years. It might have been in the 2005 session. And we had some testimony about the number of languages that had been identified and the number of ones for which there had been translated materials prepared. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but there might be somebody in the audience who does. It seems to me there was something like 11 languages, and maybe 6 or 8 or something had translated materials already. So the demographer has used some discretion in deciding how many languages really need the translated materials, and the main impact of this new bill is to require some additional materials, not just voting instructions, but other pieces of paper that go along with that. But this is not a totally new area in determining which languages get translated. Mr. Cooper looks like he's...
Mr. Cooper?
Madam Chair, Mr. Watson is correct. I believe that the last number that was recommended by the State Demographer's Office was 13. There's actually a conversation going on between the Secretary of State's office currently and the State Demographer about what that might look like in the future, and tightening up maybe what the standards are so that the state demographer has some more direction about that, and we'd like to let that conversation continue. But in this question of what we require counties to do, we really do want to allow counties the discretion of deciding whether they – I mean, the state demographer just makes the recommendation about within the state what languages need the materials to be translated into, and we would like the counties to have the flexibility to determine that, no, in fact, in a particular county, they have no need for something translated into Amharic, for example. We don't want to require that they go and post something or deliver it to every polling place. So that was our intention, to not put an unnecessary burden on county elections officials.
Is there further discussion of 1651 or questions for the witness or Senator Torres-Ray? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify in support or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 1651 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Senator Erickson Ropes. Senator Larson moves the Subcommittee on Elections report on Senate File 1218. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the committee report is adopted. Members, we have a delete everything amendment that I believe also reflects the work that was done in the subcommittee and also some technical corrections that needed to be done following the hearing there. So you do see the on the subcommittee report those corrections or those amendments, and then further and then there was a committee engrossment, which you also have, subcommittee engrossment, to reflect those amendments. But now we have a delete everything amendment that includes the amendments made by the subcommittee, but then also makes technical adjustments. So this is not a brand new bill. It's just to make it clear where changes were made. And Mr. Watson, do we need to do the A2 amendment?
No, this incorporates that as well.
So following the adoption of the subcommittee report, we now have a delete everything amendment in front of us.
That should be explained.
And I'm going to ask for that. And so this time around, Senator Erickson Ropes, we do not do this automatically because this is not the first time this bill has been heard. So you need to explain the delete everything amendment section by section.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm glad to be here before many of you again with the military overseas voting bill. And as a veteran myself, I'm very honored to bring this bill forward. Secretary of State Mark Ritchie brought me the idea to begin with. And to move things right along, I will just pass it along to Secretary Ritchie to give you an overview of what the bill does.
Mr. Secretary, we need you to explain the bill section by section, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Ritchie. I'm Secretary of State. On the delete all amendment, I want to ask my staff, Director of Government Relations, Beth Fraser, to go through the point by point on the delete all amendment.
Ms. Fraser, please identify yourself, please, for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Beth Fraser, the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's office. Although it's a delete all amendment, as the Senator Ress said, it makes very few changes, or not substantial changes. The first section of the bill allows U.S. citizens who currently cannot vote to vote. These U.S. citizens are not allowed to vote because they have not lived in Minnesota recently, or because they are children of people who used to live in Minnesota. About 20 states allow children of former residents to vote. Minnesota is one of the ones that does not. So what this language does is it would allow the child of a former Minnesota resident to vote in federal races only. The difference between the language passed by the subcommittee in this language is it changes the language so that it's clear that whether the parent is alive or dead, the child gets to vote. And, of course, we're speaking about a child, someone over 18, not a child in that sense. Okay. The second section of the bill requires that it broadens the kinds of identifications that voters can put on their application. Right now, they have to put a military ID card number or a passport number. We're also allowing them to put a driver's license number or state identification card number. Our understanding is that many overseas and military voters actually already put these numbers, even though they're not technically supposed to. If somebody doesn't have any of those numbers currently, they have to get a notary or someone else who can give an oath to witness them swearing that everything is true. We have heard from the military that this is quite burdensome and instead would allow the voter or their relative to self-certify, so to swear themselves without having a notary or some other witness that everything on the application is true. The language passed by the subcommittee would have only allowed that option for the voter. The previous language that we're deleting allowed this witness, this notary option for either the voter or a parent or a relative. So this new language in the delete all amendment clarifies that either the voter themselves who's overseas or in the military or their relative who's allowed to apply for the ballot for them could also use this option. Section 3 is a new section. It just clarifies that as county auditors are entering information into the statewide voter registration system about these voters, that they will include the identification number that was provided on the application, and that this number would therefore show up on the record provided to election judges. Section 4 allows voters to it allows us to send the ballots to voters electronically. Currently, we have to mail the ballot to the voter, and the voter has to mail it back. And what we're finding is that there are many voters in 2006, I think there were just over 200 voters whose ballots arrived after Election Day and so therefore were not counted. We want to cut the mailing time in half, and so we're allowing county auditors to send ballots electronically. They would probably email a PDF. The voter would then have to print it out and mail it back. We're not going to get into internet voting, but it would cut the mailing time in half. Section 5 has to do, again, with the numbers that are on. Now we're talking about the ballot and the returned envelope. We're saying that they need to include the same number that they put on the application. This will give us some way to verify that the application and ballot were submitted by the same person. Currently, there's really no cross-checking, and so in theory, an unscrupulous postal worker or somebody else along the line could get the ballots and send them in and just write down 1, 2, 3, 4, and there's no checking that the number on the application and the ballot matches. So this is trying to make sure that the ballot is really coming from the voter. If the voter doesn't have any of these numbers, they would again be allowed to swear that the contents is true. They would not have to get it notarized. The delete all amendment makes one very technical change on 3.23. This language said of the application, and it needs to be affidavit because that's what this paragraph is talking about. Section 6 would allow county auditors to mail replacement ballots to voters who either have moved or have lost their ballot in the mail. The way the law is written now, if followed strictly, if Senator Erickson Ropes had been at Fort Bragg, for example, and applied for a ballot, and close to the next election had been transferred to Iraq, for example, and the ballots had already been mailed to North Carolina, to Fort Bragg, technically they would be prohibited from mailing her a ballot to her new location because it says you can only mail one ballot. So, which obviously doesn't make any sense, and my understanding is that some or most county auditors are not following this law because they want to enfranchise the voters. So we're just cleaning up this issue. Section 7 is the section that has been changed. The most words have been changed. I don't think the meaning has changed very much. Senator Marty in the subcommittee pointed out that we had left some language in the subdivision referring to the county auditor and election judges not telling who a voter had voted for. That language was in place because when the bill was originally drafted, it had allowed for voters to email back their ballots. We later decided that was not the direction that we wanted to go. We weren't ready for that. And if a ballot had been emailed back, then somebody would know how the person voted. Since we're not allowing ballots to be emailed back, we no longer need that language. And if a member of the committee would move an amendment to this amendment, the language on 4.30 and the rest of that sentence on 4.31 should also be deleted.
Ms. Fraser, would you indicate where that is again?
4.30.
Yes.
And 4.31, the rest of that sentence provided in section.
So the whole line?
All of 4.30, and then on 4.31, we need to delete provided in section 206.86, subdivision 5.
So the sentence would just read, after the information, after the information on the certificate of vote eligibility has been verified, the certificate must be attached. Is that what you want?
Yes, Madam Chair. So the T would also need to be lowercase in the.
We will incorporate that change when we take up the delete the thing amendment.
Section 8, members, allows voters to use a write-in absentee ballot or a submarine ballot, which basically is a blank piece of paper with lines on it for voters who are going to be out of touch for a long period of time and either can't get the ballot or don't even know who the candidates will be, and it allows them to write down who they want who they want their votes cast for. Currently, under federal law, we allow voters to use this for federal races, and this would allow voters to use this also for state and local races.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling.
I'm really at a loss about this one. You can just pick up a piece of paper and write names of candidates in, and that's your ballot?
I have a copy.
Ms. Fraser?
Madam
are we
Chair.
Talking of, who are we, what kind of folks are we talking about that would be able to do this?
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Mr. Secretary.
Senator Roebling. The federal government has a specific, what we call submarine ballot, which they distribute, and it does not have names. It is a very official form, and that's the form that this legislation would allow. And it gets its name from people who were serving on submarines and who would be under the water for a long time. The benefit is that a soldier could go online or could call home to find out the results of the primary, and if they were nervous that their ballot would not get to them in time, they could then take the results of the primary and write down the candidates that they desired and then mail it in as part of the Uniform and Overseas Voter Act approach using this federal form.
So, Mr. Secretary, Senator Roebling, it's already being done by the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, it's already being used in Minnesota for federal races. This just allows it to be used for state and local races.
But, Senator Madam Roebling? Chair, they don't even know who the candidates are, mm-hmm. because they're not listed on any ballot. So if they've been out of the country and out of the state for maybe months, how are they supposed to know this?
Roebling, I think the notion is that the high-tech society that we live in, that submariners are going to know who those folks are,
yes.
Members of the military, and can indeed fill out their write-in absentee ballot. This is not a new authority. This is just extending the authority to state races. They have computers on submarines.
But, Madam Chair, this isn't just being proposed for submarinists. this is being proposed for anyone who doesn't think their ballot might make it back on time.
It is not a brand new authority. It is only extending it to other elections, as I understand, Senator Erickson Ropes. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
I mean, Senator Roby, you may not approve of it for either federal elections or state elections, but it's not a new authority in federal elections. Ms. Fraser, you want to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 9 of the bill, again, has to do with having the same number on the application and on the ballot. There are two changes from the subcommittee report in this section. One is that there's a brand new paragraph on lines 5.28 to 5.32. This, one of the concerns about requiring that the same number be on both the application and on the ballot was that a voter might forget which number they had put down, or if a family member had applied, they might use one number, for example, the person's Social Security number, which is the same as their military ID number, and the voter might use their Minnesota driver's license number. And that even though it was the same person, the two numbers would not match. And under the new language, in an attempt to provide security, that we would inadvertently disenfranchise some voters. So this paragraph has been added to give election judges some leeway to determine that it is the same person. I think the ideal is that this would be done by election judges before election day, which would mean using an absentee ballot board, and they would be able to, for example, if it was applied for by a relative, call the relative and ask for another number, or contact the voter and ask for another number. So this is an attempt to make sure that we do not inadvertently disenfranchise voters. The other change in this from the subcommittee report is on 5.33, just correcting the current language that had a typo, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Section 10 would give the Secretary of State, as the chief election official, emergency powers to make sure that our military folks get to vote in the case where they're called up at the last minute, and would require our office to establish rules outlining how this procedure would work.
Okay, Chair, Senator Erickson Robes, do you have more testimony?
Yes, Madam Chair. Brigadier General Tim Casalter is here today to offer some testimony. Sir?
General Casalter, if you will identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Tim Casalter. I'm Assistant to the Adjutant General in Department of Military Affairs for the state of Minnesota. We're here just essentially to support this. It allows our airmen, soldiers, sailors. Actually, we're an advocate for all the services who are deployed to vote. And it helps expedite the process. Currently, we've had members voted, but their votes did not reach the tally in time. And this allows them to do that in advance. And so we're very supportive of that initiative. Pending your questions, Madam Chair, that's the extent of my comments.
Okay. Are there questions or concerns for or comments or questions for Senator Erickson Ropes or any of the witnesses? We will begin with Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for the Secretary of State's office. Currently, do you use the military identification number as a publicly identifiable number for the serviceman member who's voting? Is there somebody who can look something up and find out what the person's military ID number is?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, no, we do not.
Okay, well, Madam Chair and Ms. Fraser, I'm trying to understand on page 2, line 13, current law says upon accepting the application, the county auditor shall record in a statewide registration system the voter's name, address, and mailing address. The new language says military identification card number, which you've indicated is a Social Security number. So that would mean that their Social Security numbers are now public information, which the military decided about 1970 to start using that, and I think they've realized that that's been kind of a mistake because with identity theft, we don't want Social Security numbers to be publicly identified, and this now, I think, would do that, would it not?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, my understanding is that the current practice is to put these numbers into the statewide voter registration system, even though it's not clearly stated in law. This would also provide the numbers to the election judges, but Social Security numbers are not public data.
So, Madam Chair and Ms. Fraser.
And Senator Betzel.
I guess I'd need a double check to make sure that the information, if you're putting the military identification card number into this statewide system, it is not because most voter registration information is public, and I'm not quite sure. I'd have to find out where it says that this would not be public, because I don't think we would want military ID numbers to become public information.
Senator Betzel, right now, when anyone orders the database, the Social Security number, driver's license numbers are not on the data. They are private acts, and any violation of that is a felony. So this is basically the current procedure.
Okay, and Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
Another question. On the emergency powers, I'm not aware if the Secretary of State has any other emergency powers. Is this the only ones that the Secretary of State would have?
Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, I do not know the answer if there are other emergency powers, but this was one of the strongest recommendations from the Pentagon to us. They gave us a series of recommendations for amendments because these kind of emergency situations do arise, and they wanted a procedure that could be established so that soldiers, sailors, or airmen could vote.
Madam Chair,
Betzold?
And Secretary Ritchie, although I recognize that we have each constitutional officer is a duly elected separate constitutional officer, it does sort of seem to me that there should probably some authority either from the president or the governor of the state, also declaring some emergency here beyond just the Secretary of State declaring there's an emergency. I think that raises a question. And I would guess that in any instance, the Secretary of State could simply not waive the dates when the ballots are due. They have to be done by Election Day. I don't know that you can go beyond Election Day. They're either in or they're not when the polls close. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Mr. Betzel.
Secretary.
It's our intention that in the rule-setting process to address all of these questions.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I just wonder if there's a way we can tighten up the language to require that there has to be some sort of presidential or gubernatorial declaration of an emergency, not just the Secretary of State declaring an emergency. I think that would be unprecedented.
Senator Betzel, the issue I would have with that is the chief election officer. Even if we had no other constitutional officers besides that office, and the only other one we had was governor, I'm not sure that I would want the independence of the chief election officer determined by another constitutional officer. Now, maybe the president of the United States would... that's different, I think. But I'm not sure that within a state we would want a governor determining whether the chief election officer would be dependent upon him or her to make that declaration. I'd be uncomfortable with that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, I don't know that... And we could broadly determine, you know, what an emergency is, but I don't know that it needs to suggest that a governor would be impeding upon the jurisdiction of the Secretary of State. However, I don't know how you would define emergency. And if you have the Secretary of State declaring an emergency that the governor does not see as an emergency, I'm just wondering... you know, where that takes us, because, you know, if it's an emergency, is it an emergency for only one issue or one? I don't know. I think it's a bit unprecedented, but I may be wrong on that.
Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I think the rules will define that the emergency is when somebody who's called up or for whatever reason will not be able to vote because the current or existing rules or procedure for applying for and returning an absentee ballot would not be possible given the situation that has unfolded. And that would be the purpose of rulemaking.
But Madam Chair, and Mr. Secretary, I don't think that would fall under what I would consider an emergency. I think it's foreseeable that there can be situations where service members are deployed on short notice. I don't know that I would use the term emergency on that. I mean, you know, that's, you know, military members expect that something may come up and they may be called on for whatever reason to leave, and that's part of the deployment process. And to that extent, you know, there should be some guidance or some rules or even some statutes that say that, you know, if a person, gets notice of deployment, here's what happens, because, you know, they may not have as their top priority, oh, by the way, I got to get my absentee ballot in. They may have other things to do in the short period of time. But whether that's an emergency, as I think of the term, I'm not quite sure. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, maybe the word emergency can just be deleted from that line. It does not add or detract.
Mr. Watson, do you have a suggestion?
Madam Chair, this is not a new issue for the Elections Committee. It was just last year that we made a change to the absentee ballot law to authorize people to vote by absentee ballot in an emergency. But that emergency is one, it says, if the governor has declared an emergency and filed the declaration with the Secretary of State under Section 12.31, 12.31 defines what is an emergency, and it includes things like illness and insurrection and natural disaster and whatnot. The declaration states that the emergency has made it difficult for voters to go to the polling place on election day. Any voter in a precinct covered by the declaration may vote by absentee ballot, etc. So I think that's going along with what you're suggesting, that we do have currently a procedure for the governor declares the emergency, and then the Secretary of State can go ahead within that and authorize this voting by absentee ballot. If I might also follow up on an earlier question that Senator Betzold had raised about the privacy of the military identification number, the voter list, the public voter list, is governed by Section 201.091, and Subdivision 9 of that section says, a list provided for public inspection or purchase for jury selection or in response to a law enforcement inquiry must not include a voter's date of birth or any part of a voter's social security number, driver's license number, or identification card number. Now, if the military ID number is the same as social security, is that protected?
Madam Chair, Mr. Watson, I don't know that it does. I mean, it just happens to be that the military identification number is a Social Security number, but I think what you just read us didn't use the term military identification card number, and this proposal does say that the military identification card number must be identified, so I think that if nothing else, the section you just read may have to be amended
right,
to also say military identification card number, because it is one of the same, but it doesn't say that.
And Madam Chair?
Mr. Watson?
The other document that's number that's not mentioned in that restricted data subdivision is the passport number. There's no reference to a passport. So it might be appropriate to add to this bill a section that amends that list of restricted data to add the military ID number and the passport.
What section, Madam Chair?
That's 201.091, subdivision 9.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Senator Betzold,
if I could then ask then, what does Section 10 do that current law does not already provide? If we can already have emergency voting procedures upon a declaration of emergency by the governor, what does this do other than empower the Secretary of State to declare an emergency?
Senator Betzold, I think what it does is give rulemaking authority to develop procedures to respond to the declaration of that emergency, but it seems to me that we could accomplish a lot of in response to your concerns by reference to other parts of the statute. And with the amendment that Mr. Watson is suggesting, Senator Erickson Ropes, we're going to lay this bill aside for a bit and maybe address those concerns, and then we'll come back to it this afternoon.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to remind the committee as well that the Section 10 emergency powers is language that comes as a recommendation from the Pentagon.
Yes, we understand. Well, I think what Senator Betzold is suggesting is that part of our statute already
right,
addresses the concern from the Pentagon, but from what he read to us is not there is the ability of the Secretary of State's office, having received that declaration, to
limit
act on it within the voting procedure.
Yes, ma'am.
So,
Madam Chair?
Sorry.
Senator Gemsy, did you have a
Before we
comment?
Set this aside, I'd like to ask a couple of questions about the federal write-in ballot thing that we looked at.
Yes, Senator Gemsy.
The question would be, will the state of Minnesota's ballot be identical to the one that we just saw?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, I think that we would actually, they would write on that same sheet the local offices, the state and local offices. On that ballot, it says, some states allow the federal write-in ballot to be used in elections other than general elections or for offices other than federal offices. So I think that you could write the office and the candidate's name and use the same sheet of paper
Madam Chair.
Senator Gimsey.
Ms. Frazier, I couldn't help but notice that on the ballot it calls for either the candidate's name or party affiliation. I guess I have some concern about our absentee ballot people writing in a party affiliation rather than a candidate's name on the ballot. Can you tell me, do we have any other ballot in the state of Minnesota where strictly party affiliation is used in voting?
Ms. Frazier?
Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, I think that some states allow you to just write down party affiliation. I'm not entirely sure, and there are some folks here that could answer the question, if in for Minnesota you would need to write down the candidate's name or whether party affiliation would be sufficient. But there are no other ballots in which you just indicate party affiliation.
Senator Gimsey?
Madam Chair, Ms. Frazier, so you're saying that the ballot will be changed to indicate that you need to put an individual's name in that blank rather than just a party affiliation. I'm not clear on that.
Ms. Frazier?
Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, I guess I'm not entirely either, and if we could come back to this after the bill is laid on the table, I can provide you with an answer.
Yes, Senator Erickson-Ropes, I think you need to review that language as well. I guess I share Senator Gimsey's reluctance to have an absentee ballot just indicate a party.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So we're going to Senate File 1218 is temporarily laid over. Senator Erickson-Ropes, you have Senate File 144.
Yes, Madam Chair. This is a bill that would grant authority to Winona County to own, construct, acquire, purchase, bond for, and operate electric power generator. They're looking at installing a windmill down there and then to sell that power output at wholesale to the electric company. And is there anyone from Xcel here? It may be not. We've been through several committees before. The Winona County people are not able to be here today, and it looks like energy people or the utilities people are not. But we have reached consensus on this bill, and I think they viewed it as the last stop, and everybody's on board with it.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Erickson-Ropes on Senate File 144? This bill has been considerably narrowed in its scope to apply only to Winona County. Are there other counties that have this?
I believe not. Madam Chair, it started out because Winona County is interested in putting up a large wind turbine. And then it was discovered that school districts have the authority to do this. Cities have the authority to do it, and counties don't. So we needed some legislation to give us permission to go ahead with the project. And the bill first was conceived as a way just to allow all counties in Minnesota, if they chose to go ahead with this sort of project. And as we went through negotiations and the stakeholders involved, the bill did get narrowed to simply Winona County. And we also started out with talking about retail, and I worked with Senator Gimsey on changing it from retail to wholesale sales of electricity back to the energy or the utilities. And we wind up with just Winona County before you, but everyone at the table, I think, recognizes that the state does want to move towards wind energy, and there may be other states, or there may be continued discussion on language that would extend this to all counties, but we're not ready to do that at this point. But Winona does want to go forward with this one single project, and that we've worked out language agreements with Xcel.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Erickson-Ropes on Senate File 144? Mr. McGowan.
Madam Chair, as I was waiting for this bill to be called, I went through it, and there's a number of technical changes that could be offered. I don't know if you'd prefer doing that here or just preparing amendment for the floor, because it's all technical, and I haven't discussed it with the senator.
need to do the work of the committee and the committee. So I think we, it looks like a lot that's there.
Written amendment might be better.
Sorry, Senator Erickson-Ropes, we're going to lay this bill aside as well, and we will get the amendment, the technical amendment, so that you will not have to do this on the floor.
Okay.
Mr. McGowan will draft that, and we'll come back to this bill as well.
Thank you very much.
The sixth bill on the agenda is going to be heard on Monday. Senator Chaudhry, Senate File 1103.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Senate File 1103 is in your committee because of some rulemaking provisions that we have regarding independent contracting.
Senator Chaudhry, would you point that section out to us, please?
Section subdivision 12 on page 7.
Senator Chaudhry, we're there.
Thanks, Madam Chair. To briefly describe the bill, what we're doing is creating a certificate for independent contractors in the construction industry for the purposes of tracking withholding taxes paid insurance issues. The reason we're doing this is because there's a growing rash of misclassification of employees, particularly within the construction industry. And that occurs when workers who should be receiving a W-2, earning a wage or a salary, instead are declared independent contractors or 1099 workers. The effect of this is that appropriate taxes are not withheld. Insurance is not paid. Workers' compensation is not paid. And this ends up putting legitimate businesses at a competitive disadvantage. It also cheats the state out of millions of dollars in revenue. It shifts financial and other risks onto workers. It dumps costs onto hospitals, insurers, competitors, and taxpayers. And it opens the door for additional illegal activities such as wage and hour violations and the use of undocumented workers. The evidence suggests that illegal misclassification is growing more rampant nationwide. And companies that do misclassify, we are finding, do it a lot because the advantages easily outweigh the risks. So although the law is clear that this type of activity is illegal, enforcement is another matter. And so that's why we are coming up with this idea to track 1099 workers in the construction industry. This language was crafted in large part by and with the Commissioner of Labor and Industry. The rulemaking, as well as some of the other tasks we are asking the Commissioner to conduct, was revealed in the last committee would have some fiscal impact. So we are offering an amendment today that would adjust the effective dates of the implementation, particularly with regards to the fees collected on the certificate, so that the bill would pay for itself and not need a fiscal note. Excuse me, not have a fiscal impact. It still may have a fiscal note. That's the A4 amendment.
Okay, so the A4 amendment is directly relevant to the rulemaking authority.
Correct.
Okay, just want to make sure it's our jurisdiction. Is there any one who wishes to question or make a comment to Senator Chaudhry?
Madam Chair, I'll move the A4 amendment.
Senator Betzel moves the A4 amendment. Is there discussion on that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 1103 before us as amended, working off of the second engrossment. Is there further discussion or comment for Senator Chaudhry? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to comment on the bill with regard to the jurisdiction of this committee?
Madam Chair, the next step would be finance.
Yes.
Okay, I'll move that Senate File 1103 as amended be recommended pass be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 1103 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. As many are as in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
We're going to skip down the list a little bit here and go to Senator Lurie's last bill. He has some witnesses here, so we'll take that. And then, Senator Day, do you have any testifiers?
I don't know if they're here. I guess they are, yes.
Okay, yeah. I think we'll go next to yours, then, instead of mine. I don't know. Senator Lurie, we have Senate File 1483.
Yes, we have Senate File 1483 before you. This is a very straightforward bill. It is also included in an agency bill, but as the Minnesota Council on Disabilities sunsets in a couple of months, several of the employees are very nervous about no longer having a job and wanted to make sure that we move this separately as well. So what this bill does is it eliminates the sunset date for the Minnesota Council on Disabilities. This is one of five state councils, and it is the only one that is still remaining with a sunset date on it. We had the Indian Affairs Council before us here last week, I guess, and there was questions raised as to the lack of a sunset date, and it's just the way we've been doing business for some time for the councils here. And
Senator Lurie, you mentioned other legislation. Was that the were they mentioned in the bill that I was carrying? No. Okay. Senator Lurie, do you have people to testify or would like to be available for questions? Whatever
Mr. Schwarzkopf, the
yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
Happy to be here.
State your name for the record, please.
State your name.
State your name for the record. Thank you.
David Schwarzkopf.
Mr. Schwarzkopf.
Where was I? I'm the chair of the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities, governor's appointment, and we are the oldest of the five councils of this type. We were brought into existence in 1973. We are a resource to the governor, to the legislature, to state agencies, and the Minnesota citizens. You have our annual report. You have the text of what I'm supposed to be saying today. My memory is good, but it's short. Anyway, one of the major things that we do, we served over 10,000 people last year. We would get into disability training. We get into a little bit of advocacy. And from my own personal anecdote, last year was the first time in my life that I was able to vote independently. And the State Council on Disabilities played a major role in making that happen. thank you for allowing me to be here today. And Senator Day, good to see you.
Good to see you.
I happen to be in living in Rochester.
Thank you, Mr. Schwarzkopf. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Schwarzkopf? Senator Lurie, do you have someone else who would like to give testimony?
I think, were you here to give testimony okay.
Yep. Ken Rogers.
Ken Rogers.
Sir, if you would identify yourself for the record, we'd be pleased to have your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Ken Rogers. I am one of the appointed members on the council. There are a total of 15 appointed members by the governor to the council, State Council on Disability. In order to complete our statutory mandate each year, which is rather extensive, and as you can see by the annual report you have before you, our legislative work and agenda is quite extensive. Besides all of the accomplishments that we do each year, we have to set aside time to kind of fight for our survival each biennium. And that takes away from the time that we can serve other people with disabilities and other agencies in the state. So we're just asking for your support in the removal of our sunset.
Are there questions of this witness or comments? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you could explain on the when you made the comment about fighting for your survival, does that mean that the sunset is something that
July 1 of 07
okay.
or June 30th of 07.
Okay. I'm just generally, I guess, Madam Chair, I'm a fan of sunsets. I mean, there's a purpose, a policy purpose in doing that. It's not supposed to be any kind of a threatening thing to snuff anybody out of existence. It's supposed to force a review to say, okay, is this board or commission or task force or group, are they still viable? Are they meeting? Are they doing things? And the vast majority of them, when we come for the review, we will extend the sunsets. But sometimes we say, well, this really they haven't met in years. Maybe it's time just to let it sunset. That's the purpose of the sunset. And I'm just curious, is the sunset here, is it onerous? Or I guess the comment about fighting for survival, I'm curious if you could explore that.
Well, sure. Madam Chair, Senator.
Mr. Rogers.
The fighting for survival of the, is something that's ongoing each biennium, and we have to come forward this isn't a political issue. We're not talking about whether or not we've met during the year. We have our report to the state legislature each year outlines our credentials and really speaks for itself. When we, as a small agency, have an enormous amount of work to do and have to take time for our employees to set aside time to prepare materials and go before committees, it's little to do with our reputation or we've been around for 35 years. I think that in and of itself speaks for it. That speaks volumes. The amount of work that is done by the council, the number of contacts that are made within the agency, the number of collaboratives we have with other state agencies, the list goes on, and you have that before you. To come before committees and to have to wonder about the continuation is onerous. It really is onerous. The other issue is, each time, it looks like we're new money to the state. We're having to not be in the overall budget. It looks like we're brand new money each time. And that's sort of an unfair burden on our council. The other four councils don't have that burden. We do.
Senator Lurie, Senator Gerlach, I think that the sunsets, and Mr. Bottom can correct me, we had sunsets in 03, and then we had sunsets in 07 for precisely this purpose. And it seems to me that, my opinion, Senator Lurie, you can comment too, that one of the things that's included in this law, our proposal, is that this particular group is not merely advisory, and that that would be, Senator Lurie, I'll ask you, I mean, is that why you're proposing that this group not only have an extension of a sunset, but be relieved of that, of their sunset period? And the other, and I'm also curious about the other councils that are not subject to the sunset provision period, Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair.
Let me ask counsel. Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair, I'm going to need a moment. I believe the other councils are within the Department of Human Services. I'm not sure exactly which councils are being referred to that don't have the sunset date.
It's the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. It's the Council on Black Minnesotans. It's the Council on Affairs of Chicano and Latino.
Is that in 15059?
No. The Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans is 3.9226.
It's in Chapter 3.
Yeah.
That's correct. That they
As is the Council on Black Minnesotans, as is the Council on Affairs of Chicano Latino, and
So Senator Gerlach, right. Those are others,
and
don't either.
To speak to your point about not purely advisory, if you look, I mean, the mission statement itself talks of a technical assistance role. The Council on Disabilities collaborates and advocates to expand opportunities for disabled people. They're really a true partner, and each of the other four of the five councils of this type have this same language that because their role is beyond that of just advising, they do not sunset. And I mean, I can attest to the I don't think that it is necessarily political and really at risk of death of this council, but for the folks at this council that are working at this council, that July 1 date does cause them a great deal of anxiety as it fast approaches and unexpected things happen in our legislative process, and it really, in my mind, is justified that we relieve them from that anxiety, if not from the true risk.
Senator Gerlach?
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate that. That's why I want to explore that a little bit, because from my perspective, I look and I see it's just on paper, and I don't see the human side of it, or what you have to go through mm-hmm. when you're dealing with that, and that you feel that that's sort of the sword of Damocles or something hanging over your head, and I didn't see it as that perspective, so I appreciate that very much, and I can certainly support this bill today, and I just want us to be cognizant of the fact that sunsets do serve a public policy purpose, and that we should, I like the idea of having them with these to force us to review. Otherwise, the law, the statute books just get bigger and bigger, and we never review them. So, I appreciate that.
I would like to concur with your concerns, and I did ask these same questions, and the folks from the Minnesota Council on Disabilities can attest to that. I was saying, now explain to me why, because we do want to have sunsets typically and make sure that that boards and councils are performing their duty. And
Are there other questions for Senator Lurie? Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, just to add a historical perspective, too, I was on this committee about 10 years ago, and there were a number of advisory groups, maybe some councils or some organizations that were out there that were never meeting. You know, we had some that had been appointed, and they never did anything. They never met, so we tried to clean them up, and then we went through a process where we were giving everybody sunsets to force us to review them. Well, what wound up happening was that as the sunsets kept coming up for each one of them, we just kept extending them out because we didn't have the time to review it. And in many cases, we just eliminated the sunset. I think that we're just kind of getting to the end of the stream there. So I think at least the ones that, clearly serve a purpose are the ones that now we've eliminated the sunsets on. There'll still be maybe a few more out there, and I think this is just one of them that we just kept rolling ahead. So.
Well, and Senator Betzold, in the bill that we had last week, we identified and repealed the language in the statutes of ones that had already been repealed. And at that point, we found that there were a few more that said, oh, no, we are very, very active, and please don't repeal our statutory language. And that was part of the point of that.
Right.
So are there other questions for Senator Lori? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify either in support or opposition to Senate File 1483? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 1483 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Day, are you ready with your bill?
Taking that.
Senator Dave, this is the second committee for this bill. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, it is.
Okay. And we have then the Senate File 170, the first engrossment, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Day, Senate File 170.
Basically, this is a bill that would it came to me from actually the Owatonna City Council, where a lady came there, and her husband was in Iraq. And what it basically does is it gives an exemption, and not forever, but a special assessments of a city. And it isn't like the city is going to do away with the payments on special assessments. The person would have to make it, but it would be deferred for a period of time. And maybe testify.
Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Eric Allness, Department of Military Affairs. And as Senator Day mentioned, this is a deferment would not alleviate the service member of the debt, but merely delay it until a time when they can better afford to make the payments. And when you talk about hardship, you can look at basically three cases here. First of all, a significant majority of Guard or reservists who deploy earn less money when they're deployed, about 45%. So you're looking at people already looking at earning less money. And then many times when they do deploy, the stay-behind spouse is working less hours or quitting work altogether so she can spend time at home, or he spend time at home with the children, since one of the parents is now suddenly gone. And then finally, there's extra expenses when a service member deploys, as they tend to buy things wherever they go to help them accomplish their mission and make their life a little more comfortable. So as you look at all three of these circumstances, you can see where it becomes a hardship suddenly to be faced with these additional bills on paying the special assessments. So this deferment would allow it to be delayed until a time they can better afford it as a family. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there questions for Senator Day or comments? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition of this bill? Senator Day then moves that Senate File 170 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to taxes.
I do, Madam Chair.
Okay. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator
Thank
Day
you,
and
Madam
Colonel,
Chair.
Colonel Allness. Senator Larson, why don't we move to your bills at this point. So we do have the two Larson bills, one more Lori bill, and then four rest bills. Senator Larson, would it be okay if we took up 1558 first?
That'd be fine, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'd move the subcommittee report on Senate File 1558 of the Election Subcommittee for adoption.
Senator Larson moves adoption of the Subcommittee on Elections Committee report for Senate File 1558. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the committee report is adopted. Senator Larson, we now have Senate File 1558 before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1558 is a very brief, simple bill that provides for election contribution limits for judicial candidates. Current law does not provide election contribution limits, and it seems that with all other state offices that we have those limits, that it seems reasonable that placing a limit in the statute makes some sense so we don't have any circumstances where we have outrageously large contributions. Madam Chair, the bill uses the same contribution limit as is the case for the governor at $2,000 in an election year per individual and $500 in other years. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Larson with regard to Senate File 1558? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in support or opposition to this bill? Mr. Cooper, if you identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Cooper with the Minnesota Voting Rights Coalition. We'd like to speak in favor of this bill and give you just a couple words of background briefly.
Very briefly. We did hear the bill
Without
controversy in the election subcommittee.
Okay. Well, I'll just say then that there is an unfortunate national trend of very large contributions coming in to buy judicial elections since a Supreme Court decision in 2002, the White decision, which allows judicial candidates to take positions on issues that may appear before them in the courts and campaign on those issues, to take money from people that may appear before them in court, and to get partisan endorsements. This is a recipe for having a lot of money come into our election system and having people on the bench who are there for reasons not of supporting the law but of pushing partisan agendas. We believe that that's a bad idea, as do many people on the bench right now. Former Minnesota Supreme Court Justice Kathleen Blatz supports getting money out of politics, as does the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. We believe that a small step in moving us in the direction of keeping partisanship and big money out of judicial races and keeping judicial activism from happening in Minnesota is imposing reasonable limits on contributions to judicial candidates.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Are there comments or questions for Senator Larson, Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with this, but I'm just wondering about the constitutional test, if it's challenged, because they're not really signing an agreement like we are when we accept campaign finance limits, and in return we get public subsidies. So how is this going to hold up in a court case?
Senator Larson?
Well, Madam Chair, maybe I could ask Ms. Jean Olson from the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board to address that briefly.
Ms. Olson, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, Jean Olson, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Candidates for the legislature agree to spending limits. Contribution limits are constitutional in the statute. So they're statutory. You don't agree to contribution limits. You agree to spending limits.
Mm-hmm. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, also, we are one of only a handful of states that have no contribution limits at this time, the other states being Alabama and a couple other states that don't have particularly good election laws. Most states, even many states that traditionally don't have good election laws like Texas, have contribution limits. It's sort of odd that we do
not. For judicial candidates.
For judicial candidates, excuse me.
Are there other questions or comments for Senator Larson?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I had to step out to talk about one of the other bills we had here. So does that mean that the judicial candidates also have the spending limits tied in here too?
Ms. Olson just mentioned that is
spending.
That is totally separate. The contribution limits are set in law independent of the agreements that legislators and others make to accept public subsidy by controlling their spending limits.
And that applies to the
regardless, regardless of whether you accept spending limits, everyone is bound by a contribution limit.
Right.
Okay. Are there further questions for Senator Larson or comments? Anyone else in the office in the room would like to speak either in support or opposition to Senate file 1558. Senator Larson then moves that Senate file 1558, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment and the bill is passed. Senator Larson, you have now Senate file 893.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, what I'd like to work off of, and it should be in your packet, is a delete everything amendment. And the reason that we...
Senator Larson, first of all, we do need to adopt a subcommittee report.
Madam Chair, I move adoption of the subcommittee report on the Committee of Elections for Senate File 893.
Senator Larson moves adoption of the committee report on... of the Subcommittee on Elections of Senate File 893. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the report is adopted. We do have a delete everything amendment. We will want you to explain it rather than automatically adopting it. Senator Larson.
Sure. Madam Chair, and thank you. Just to preface the discussion as it relates to the delete everything amendment, I know there are times when delete everything amendments come with a lot of new policy, and that is not the case in this circumstance. As we've moved through the process, there have been different dates that we need to move as it relates to moving the primary to June, and that principally is what we have in this. But I will walk through section by section very quickly, because most of these do deal with dates, Madam Chair. But Madam Chair, Section 1 changes from September 1st to a week before the state primary, the date when the Commissioner of Revenue tells us what is available in the party account. It advances, Section 2 advances the filing deadline for the Commissioner of Revenue to estimate the amount that each candidate will be eligible for to receive in both the general account and the party account of the state elections campaign fund, and also advances the last day for filing of office, as well as the deadline for the Campaign Finance Public Disclosure Board to notify candidates of the amounts that they will be eligible to receive. Section 3 changes the deadline for candidates to file spending limit agreements at least 1 week before the candidate state primary. Again, from September, Section 4 changes the deadline for candidates to submit affidavits for their matching contributions to at least 1 week before the state primary. Section 5 changes the date of the precinct caucuses from the first Tuesday in March to the third.
Senator Larson, how would those dates have an impact on the bill that we sent to the floor and passed on to the House about the making simultaneous the reporting date along with the affidavit of contributions, so that the affidavit of contributions is not a game that candidates play?
Madam Chair, that is a really good question that I hadn't thought about. We had taken that up some time back. I don't know if Gene Olson, if you've thought about that, Gene.
Yeah. And the issue would be, I think you agreed with the policy that was in that bill, and if that bill actually passed first, and then this bill comes along and passes, then it undoes that language that would be inconsistent with this one, I believe. Ms. Olson?
Madam Chair, I think you're correct. You'd need to do some amending of this bill if that one passes. Otherwise, the people would have to raise their contributions by June sometime, and that probably isn't fair. So there'd have to be some rewording of this if that passes off and gets signed.
Hmm. Senator Larson,
Madam Chair, you'd maybe want to just put in a date like August 1st or something like that. It would take away what the bill that we that you passed earlier does is to ensure that the money is raised, but it would be difficult for people to raise the money by the primary in many cases.
I don't see an immediate solution here.
I don't either, Madam Chair.
Senator Larson, I wonder, wouldn't usually do this, but maybe we could just act on your bill and then before you take it up to make it consistent with a bill that has already passed the Senate. That's my concern there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Has not been acted on in the House yet, and I'm not sure if it's on the floor or where it is. But
thank you, Madam
Chair. I don't want to undo the work there because I think we identified some real problems that had occurred in some prior elections to make the process, quite frankly, more transparent and honest. But
thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the one potential solution would be to for now to delete Section 4 so that we don't inadvertently change that. We have an implementation date or an effective date of 2010.
That's right.
So we would have some time to fix that or integrate the new law into this.
I do think, Senator Larson, I think that is a fix. Even though I know you were trying to address the new dates, maybe if you kept those sections, and Mr. Watson's not here because he's drafting amendments on another bill, but if you kept those sections that refer to those dates actually out of the bill, then if this is passed, we can come back and use the because we have three more sessions before we would have to deal with that and still make the what I think, I mean, it's my bill, but wasn't just my ideas to make this procedure in sync with the disclosure requirements and et cetera.
Madam Chair, I would agree with you there, and I think that there was general agreement that the change that is made in your bill is an important change that we'd want to incorporate at some point.
So would that mean that the, I mean, is that like sections, okay, it wouldn't mean if we go through this one by one, and it's a little bit tedious, but I think it would be helpful. It wouldn't change Section 1, wouldn't change Section 2, and I'm hoping Ms. Olson is following along with this for me. Wouldn't change Section 1 or Section, or have an effect on Section 1 or Section 2.
Thank you.
It would not affect Section 3, but it definitely would affect Section 4. And so, Senator Larson, just to start with, I wonder if you would move to delete Section 4.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would move to delete Section 4 from the Delete All Amendment, the A7 Amendment.
So, Senator, we're going to do this for modifying. Senator Larson modifies the A7 Amendment to exclude Section 4. I don't believe Section 5 or I don't believe, maybe it's the case that not any of the others are affected by that other.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I don't believe that the other sections are affected by the affidavit of contribution.
Okay, so then just go on then from Section 5
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Your other date changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 5 changes the precinct caucus dates. Again, moving that back, given the shorter time period. Section 6 changes the deadline is increased from 30 to 45 days before the election for making absentee ballots available to voters. That is one of the differences in the bill than from what we heard in the subcommittee, and you'll find later later section here, which is when I get to that section, the policy issue there is providing ample time to address the issue of military personnel voting, so that our military personnel have the opportunity to participate not only now in the general election, which will be easier with a longer time span, but also to be able to vote in that state primary as well. Section 7 changes the deadline for establishing a combined polling place, where we have polling places combined to 14 weeks before the state primary. Section 8 changes the deadline for changing a precinct boundary when that's necessary. Section 9 changes the deadline for parties to provide lists of election judges to county auditors to within 2 weeks after the precinct caucuses, and also the deadline for county auditors to provide lists to city councils, town boards, and county boards to within 4 weeks after the precinct caucuses. Section 10 changes the deadline for the Secretary of State to notify the county auditor of which offices will be voted on in the county in that general election, and or to 15 weeks before the primary. Section 11 is the section that changes the deadline for delivering absentee ballots to county auditors and municipal clerks from 30 to 45 days prior to the election, again expanding that time frame for military personnel. Section 12 changes the deadline for the Secretary of State to prescribe the forms for election returns to 10 weeks before the state primary. Section 13 changes the date of the state primary, which is the major provision of the bill, to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in June. Section 14 changes the date of a municipal primary from September to the date of the primary. Section 15 changes the deadline for the affidavit of candidacy for municipal offices. Section 16 changes the date for school district primaries for the state primary. Section 17 changes the deadline for a school district office filing of affidavit of candidacy as well. Section 18 changes the deadline for submitting to the Secretary of State a plan for the use of electronic voting systems to 10 weeks before the state primary. Section 19 changes the opening date for suspending municipal ordinances, and this section also is different from what we discussed in subcommittee, Madam Chair, related to the issue of permission for the limits on lawn signs. Section 20 changes the deadline for the affidavit of candidacy for hospital board. Section 21 provides the effective date of 2010. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 893 that moves the primary to June and the precinct caucuses to third week in February, I believe will provide us a couple of things. One is a focus of the general election on the choice between the major party candidates, rather than a focus on the primary contest. Instead of the inter-party battle, the public will have a longer period of time to view the difference between general election party candidates. It also will allow for sufficient time for military personnel to be enfranchised in our state, which has been a challenge in the past. And members, it provides additional time so that that narrow window does not disenfranchise our military voters. Madam Chair, this has been not an idea that I thought up. It's been an idea that's been worked on for many years and has actually had success in the Senate in recent years, but has also been worked on by many people that are interested in elections in Minnesota. This year there is a group that formed called the Council on Electoral Leadership, and I have with me who would like to testify, Nathan Meeks, from the council, which was a bipartisan group that include individuals from many parties.
At least tripartisan.
That's right, Madam Chair. In fact, the council included, if I'm not wrong, the members of each of the major parties, either current chairs or former chairs, and in many cases, multiple so in terms of former party chairs from both the Democrat and Republican parties. And I also have with me Donna Cassett, the associate chair of the Democratic Party. And so with that, Madam Chair, if there are no questions, I would ask Ms. Meeks to provide testimony.
Ms. Meeks, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Annette Meeks, and I'm a co-chair of the Council for Electoral Leadership. And as Senator Larson pointed out, our Council for Electoral Leadership is comprised of 74 civic, business, labor, and political leaders representing, I'll coin a new term today, quad partisan, Democrat, Republican, Independence parties, and even a few independent folks, as well as some regular voters. It's mostly, though, and you also touched on former chairs of the major parties, former statewide candidates, former elected officials, and most importantly, folks who are very active participants in our electoral process. What brought us all together earlier this year was a belief in our great electoral participation here in Minnesota, but we did seek consensus on a couple issues we thought could use some minor improvements, and one of which was moving our primary from September to June. And that improvement we thought was so important that we asked our legislative leaders that if it could stand alone in the legislative process to demonstrate our commitment to this effort. I'll give you three very quick reasons why the council supported this in a quad partisan fashion this year. And the first and most important one we've heard quite a bit about today, it's a very practical one, and that is, of course, the fact that we have a primary currently in September and a general election that's merely 7.5 weeks away. That's too short a time for county election officials to properly manage the business of absentee voting, including our somewhat 11,000 Minnesota National Guard troops that have been stationed overseas. And very quickly, I think it's important to note also this is not a new idea. My second point today is in 1939, the primary date changed from mid-June to September. It's unclear what the reasoning was behind the state changing the primary election, but I do think if the elected officials who were around back in 1939 could see what they wrought with that, meaning some very tough, quick, hard-hitting, nasty attacks on candidates from all persuasions, they probably would have paused before they created a short election season like we currently have. We do believe a June primary would allow all of our political parties and candidates to endorse their candidates and then approximately 4 weeks later cast a ballot for those preferred candidates. We wouldn't have the inter-party fights that go on currently all summer long and well into the fall. Candidates would be also assured of their place at their respective county fair booths, and most importantly, they could be featured very prominently at the state fair. And last but not least, as all of you know, candidates can attest to voters' preference to really being able to talk directly to voters one-on-one about ideas. A longer general election season would afford, in our opinion, candidates that ability to meet with more voters in several different ways. As a matter of fact, that was the principal reason several years ago for the primary, moving the primary to an earlier date put forth by the Grow Commission. Our overall goal at the Council for Electoral Leadership is to garner greater participation of Minnesotans from all walks of life in a vibrant electoral process. Sadly, our current primary does little or nothing to increase participation in our democracy. We've seen a slow but steady decline in Minnesota primary voters since 1970, when our primary election participation hit a high watermark of 32%. The numbers since then are quite alarming. In 1998, 17% in 2000, 14% in 2002, and 16% this last September. Minnesota, we believe, needs strong and vibrant political candidates if we're to continue to lead the nation in our general election turnout, and we can excite more people, involve more new voters, but most importantly, stop the disenfranchisement of a few voters by making the simple switch to June. Thank you, Chairman Rest, and for hearing this bill, and we thank Senator Larson and Senator Gerlach for your leadership on this important issue.
Thank you, Ms. Meeks. Are there questions or comments for Ms. Meeks? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Meeks, I guess I would debate with you the ability to increase participation by moving the primary ahead. I think that when you lose the opportunity for people to meet the primary candidates, when they don't have the summer in Minnesota, when they don't have the community festivals, the county fairs, and the state fair, and they don't know who they are, they're going to be less likely to vote in June. And I think that choosing those top candidates is a very, very important task and should have the multitudes at the table making that selection. And I really am concerned that by pushing it ahead, we are not going to get the voters' attention. We will have lower voter turnout and lower participation in picking one of those top winners. The other thing that I'm concerned about, and I realize that this is a party issue, but this move of the primary affects hundreds, if not thousands, of other candidates who are not affiliated with parties. I mean, when you had your group, did someone come to represent the hospital boards and the county boards and the town boards and the city councils, the township boards? Everybody who will have to now move their filing date up until April, first week in April, they have to file by for a November election. And I'm thinking, are people even going to bother? Are they going to be thinking about those smaller races then, so that they can be on the ballot in November and they have to file by the first week in April, and they're nonpartisan, and yet they all get affected by this too. And I have real concerns about that. I can see where maybe we should move the primary up a month so we can deal with the absentee ballot issues. I understand that, you know, there might be a little bit of a time crunch there. But to move it up and require filings 3.5 months before we currently require them for all offices is just really a big push to me. And I think we're going to lose participation, both participation of candidates and participation of voters.
Senator Larson, do you want to respond, or Ms. Meeks, or anyone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd briefly respond to a couple of points, and then maybe Ms. Meeks would like to respond as well. As it relates to the change for other offices, one of the things that I think will help with that is the 2010 implementation date. This is not effective until 2010. There's no doubt that there is some adjustment period, but I will admit what we're bringing forward is a major reform, and that is moving our primary to June. And as Ms. Meeks testified, that change to September was made many, many, many years before now, and we're attempting to go essentially back. And it's a major change, and I just think that on whole, as you analyze where we've been in recent elections and what the future can be, that the public is better served by a longer discussion from candidates and opposite parties rather than that long primary battle. And we may disagree about that, but I will admit that there's probably an adjustment period, but I would propose that may be less confusing than having a number of different deadlines for different offices, and that keeping one primary is beneficial to Minnesota.
Thank you. Just a couple comment. Quick things. This bill doesn't affect the nonpartisan elections that currently occur in off years, so it would only be those that are in compliance, and we do have 3 years to kind of work through those differences. There are only four states that have primaries later than us, Madam Chair, and that is part of our concern, is even moving it to August, which we did debate quite seriously, our concern was that doesn't really alleviate how do we get more people excited and involved in the electoral process. August in Minnesota is vacation time. And we don't start schools then. We shouldn't be having people go cast ballots then, something equally important. The only other thing I would add, too, is we really envisioned party contests, endorsing candidates. You'd garner a great deal of earned media when you have those party contests. And then 4 weeks later, those people plus the state as a whole would be encouraged to go vote. While it's still fresh in the minds of the party partisans, if you will, who they endorsed and who those candidates are. And it also gives, we believe, a leg up to legislative candidates because there will be attention focused on the elections while people are focusing on party endorsements, party conventions, different things like that, rather than now where everything kind of just stops during the summer months and then we have to hurry up and get up to full speed again in September. That was our primary concern of moving it back to June versus August.
Madam Chair.
And Senator Roebling.
Has anyone looked at voter turnout percentages in other states? Did June primaries garner larger than our September primary percent of voter turnout in other states?
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Senator Roebling, that's a good question and something that we'll have to look more closely at. The only danger, I think, in trying to compare what happens in other states to Minnesota is we all have different voting patterns in terms of turnout. And I think it'd be difficult unless you see what the difference is between if their primary is earlier in the year and there was a recent change. That might be the best data to look at. And that's a good point. I'll go back and look for that data to see how many states have changed within a fairly recent period of time and see what sort of differences they experience.
Ms. Cassett, do you have comments?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Donna Cassett, Associate Chair of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. And I'm here today to state that the Minnesota DFL party enthusiastically is in favor of Senator Larson's bill, Senate File 893. In fact, we testified last session in favor of this, a similar bill. And the party has long favored this much-needed reform. We strongly believe that the focus should instead be on who would be the better public officer, not the better Democrat, the better Republican, or the better Independence Party candidate, that the process should actually be less about politics and more about good government. So this would, in our view, refocus the debate during the election cycle on who will actually hold office rather than the party nominating process. Right now, we spend about 4.5 months essentially playing inside baseball and then give the voters less than 2 months to judge the product of the partisan party's work. We believe that we should reverse that cycle, give the voters more time to make their decision and less time for the parties to make their decisions. The DFL party is also very much in favor of moving the caucus date to late February, lining up with Wisconsin. And hopefully this will bring a little bit more of attention to Minnesota in the presidential elections. Right now we're behind most of the other states, as Ms. Meeks has stated, and we'd like to participate that in a little bit more fully. So my hope is that the full committee and the full legislature will act favorably upon this bill, as it's been a much-needed reform for a very long time, and I thank you very, very much for your time and your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Cassett. Are there questions or comments for this witness? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, you said that you think that the voters want more than 2 months to make their decision on the final candidate. I have heard so many comments, especially after this last or during this last election cycle, of people who would say, I can't wait till this is over. Mm-hmm. I just can't wait till these elections are over. I am sick to death of them. So now we're going to give them 3.5 more months of it. And how sick to death of them will they be by the time November comes around? I just have grave concerns. I don't think we're really doing it for the voters. We're doing it for the parties. And again, we're going to involve all these other candidates at all the other levels of government that aren't associated with parties, and we're kind of hauling them all into it. And I just think that the voters are not asking for longer elections, and with longer elections is going to become more expensive elections, and I just don't believe the voters are asking for it.
Senator Roebling, I think my response to that is the election isn't going to be any longer. It's just what kind of election it's still going to end in November, and it's whether we want to be talking about who's the better Democrat or the better Republican or the better Green Party candidate or independent, or whether we want to be talking about who would be the better office holder. And I don't know that either system either enhances or takes away or diminishes the nastiness of any individual candidate or their campaign. But I think the discussion will be better focused, I think, and I don't know that there's increased participation, but we're trying to structure, or by doing this, it seems to me that the structure of the political discussion is fundamentally changed, and which is why I support it. But it doesn't make the election any longer. It's just who's going to be doing the debating. And but on the other side of that, what I would grant is it's going to be Republicans are not going to be spending their campaign dollars trying to defeat other Republicans. They're going to be spending their campaign dollars to defeat candidates in my party. Right. And I think that by getting their message out, and the same thing I think goes, to be quite honest, on the DFL side, you'd have people not running against other members of their party and spending all their campaign funds to do that, to win a primary, and instead they're able to make spend their dollars making their case against candidates from nominated from other parties, as well as those who would file as independents with no party.
But Madam Chair, we're not eliminating the need to spend money for a primary, because there's still going to be a primary. It'll just move it back to January that they'll start spending instead of in March. I mean, it's just going to change the starting time to me.
Well, that's a point well taken, too. I don't think it's going to be as long, though, I guess.
Madam Chair.
Senator Larson.
And I would just add, Madam Chair, as we've entered the next cycle in the next 2 years toward the 2008 elections, it seems like the U.S. Senate race is almost in full swing. Whether Minnesotans like it or not, the campaign cycles and seasons sort of begin with the ending of the previous election. And I don't know that, and I don't believe that this bill really changes that. I think it changes the order in which we debate things, but I don't think it lengthens the election. I think that is almost beyond the power of the legislature, and it's just a matter of the election marketplace.
Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, no matter what the law says or how the rules are, every one of the seats is going to be filled in the legislature and the county board, city councils, and so forth. And I suspect that the victors will all say, well, the system must work because I got elected.
Right.
So no matter how you adjust the rules, there's going to be somebody winning. Now, maybe that is going to affect the outcome. In my own personal case, frankly, I had to run against an incumbent from my own party. And I needed additional time over the summer to help get my name out, to do things that, in order to prevail. And I don't know that would have worked if I would have had an earlier primary, but, those were the rules that I ran under, and that's what I think, ultimately helped. But I don't know that it's going to turn out any more voters in a June primary, because I think many voters just see it as a partisan thing. My own mother never votes in primary elections because she says, that's just for the parties to decide. I say, yeah, but, look at me. I mean, you got to vote in the primary to decide what. Well, she didn't, I don't
care.
I'm not going to vote in the primary.
Okay.
She didn't live in my district, so I that was fine. But, um, But I think people who are going to vote in a primary, whether you put it in June or September, are probably going to vote in the primary. And I don't know that you're going to get any more people showing up because of you changed the date. I still think that most people just don't pay attention to this stuff until after Labor Day. And that's when it kicks in. Now, it just happens to be that we right now we have that as a primary, but so they vote then. But I think as far as the general election goes, I think it certainly was my experience last year. I could door knock in June and July and August, and people said, oh, yeah, that thing's coming up sometime, you know. And they didn't really pay attention until, you know, September rolled around. And I don't think that changing the dates is going to really affect that. That's when people start thinking about the general election is in September.
Is there other comment or questions? Anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify, either in support or opposition to this bill? Then we have the Delete Everything Amendment before us, modified with the deletion of Section 4. Senator Larson?
Deleted this section from the bill because it's possible.
If I move this, it'll fix it. And does Senator Rest have this? Very good.
Madam Chair, I have Council has just handed me an amendment that would address the issues that that relate to the bill that you have passed.
Okay.
And having just received it, Council tells me that that this essentially would insert into the A7 amendment, and we could incorporate into the A7 amendment the language.
It would make it only applicable to this 2010 date.
That's correct, Madam
And would
Chair.
Not affect the 2008 election.
Fix our problem, Madam Chair.
Yes. So Senator Larson modifies his amendment then by modifies the A7 amendment with the A8 amendment. And so we have the Delete Everything Amendment before us, the A7 Amendment. Is there further discussion? All those in favor of the A7 Amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Well, that was the whole thing?
That's the Delete Everything Amendment.
No.
Okay. I was waiting.
I thought we were voting on the A8. I'm sorry.
No. Okay. We modified the A7 by the A8. The motion prevails, and the A7 amendment as modified by the A8 amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 893 before us as amended. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in favor or opposition to Senate File 893 as amended?
Sure.
Senator Roebling.
Can I have a technical question? I know that in 2012 we will be redistricting, and I know that in the past we often did not know what those legislative districts would look like until February or March, or maybe it was even later. It was late last time, and so I'm just wondering what assurance do we have that we will know what the districts look like so that there is ample time before and a first week of April filing period that people can know if they have a district to run in or if we have open seats and open districts. What assurance do we have in a redistricting year that
Senator
will be
Gerlach?
Done in time?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Roebling, I think that what happens in practice is we tend to fill the void regardless of when that deadline would be. And if the deadline was known that there are filings, that certainly lights a fire under whatever the legislative process is, or if we end up in the courts, that sort of thing. Everybody knows what the deadline is, so they're, like I say, they're going to get it done by that time, I would imagine. I can't imagine that they would let it drag. They could have to get it done, so they would force themselves to accommodate to the schedule.
Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair, do we have anything in statute now that said it has to be done by a certain time, and would we need to adjust that?
Mr.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, yes, we do. I think it's 204B.135 says that the deadline is 25 weeks before the state primary, so 6 months or so. So we're talking really sometime in December, the end of December would be the deadline. which as a practical matter means that the legislature would have no opportunity to be passing a plan in the even-numbered year. They'd have to get it done in the odd-numbered year or in a special
session. In 2011. Whether it would be in the special session or in a special session or in the regular session.
Right.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Larson.
And as thinking about this, it, as a practical matter, it may actually require that the process be played out and be more open to the public in terms of not having those late decisions about primaries or about the precincts happening right upon the election. Those issues are going to be resolved, you know, further ahead of time. And with some of the dates in here, that also drives that in terms of when we require a final precinct to be drawn. And so that's also part of the deadlines that we've changed in the bill.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 893, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Larson.
Making a mistake.
Senator Lurie. Mr. Watson, have we resolved the issues that were brought up in Senator Erickson Rope's bill?
Madam Chair, I believe we have, and we have an A5 amendment to be distributed.
Then we'll go back to her since she's not a member of the committee. What about Senate File 144? Are we going to be getting that one too? Senator Erickson Ropes, do you know whether the technical amendment to Senate File 144 is being drafted?
Ms. McGowan? I have 144 in front of me, and I also have 1218.
Great. We'll do both of your bills then.
Thank you.
Hope that they've met
Chair,
the
great
considerations.
To be back before this committee for the second time today.
Okay. So Senate File now, 1218 is once again before us. We had not adopted the delete all amendment. I think it'd be easiest if we would go ahead and do that, and then we'll go to the amendment to that. Senator Larson moves the delete all amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. So we have the delete all amendment before us, and now we have the A5 amendment. Senator Erickson Ropes, would you please explain the A5 amendment, and then we will accept a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll turn that over to Beth Fraser.
Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Beth Fraser from the Secretary of State's office. Section lines 1.4 through 1.9 add a section to the statute, the section that says that the Social Security number shall not be part of the list that can be purchased. We have added military identification number or passport number to the list of things that may not be included. Line 1.10 and 1.11 are the technical change that I had mentioned when originally presenting the delete all amendment, deleting some text related to not revealing who a voter had voted for. Line 1.12 through 1.14 relate to the issue that Senator Gimsey raised about not wanting voters to be able to just indicate a political party. Under federal law, we need to allow voters to just indicate a party for the federal offices. However, you may, for state offices, restrict it to a candidate. So the plan is that we would have our own state write-in ballot, and on that it would indicate that they had to list the office and the candidate's name for the state and local offices.
Senator Gimsey, does that address the issue?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you.
That you raised, yes, okay. Ms. Fraser?
The rest of the amendment replaces the section having to do with emergency powers, using some of the language from the other piece of statute that Mr. Watson referenced. so that it says in the case of when a governor has declared an emergency or if a natural disaster or armed conflict involving the troops makes compliance with the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act impossible or unreasonable, the Secretary of State may, through emergency orders, figure out how to get the troops to vote, and then has a rulemaking procedure.
Senator Betzold.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think this addresses the concerns. The head note says emergency powers. It is slightly broader than that, but it does address the situation, first of all, that if the governor declares an emergency, or if you just happen to have a situation, it's not an emergency, but if there's some situation involving the mobilization, deployment of the military forces, whether it is to the next state or whether it's to around the world, you know, there should be some situation under which the Secretary of State can have promulgate rules for those situations. So I think that this covers the concerns that I had.
Thank you. So Senator Betzold then moves the A5 amendment. Is there further discussion of the A5 amendment? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify in favor or in opposition to this? Seeing none, we have the Betzold motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For discussion's sakes, I would like to move to delete subdivision 2, 1.5 through 1.14. And I have a real discomfort with...
I see.
You're just deleting section 1.
Pardon?
She's deleting section 1.
You're deleting, actually, section 1.
It would be all of section 1. You're right. That's all. Should I explain what my concern is here?
Of course.
You know, the way it was before the new language makes some sense to me. But to have somebody claiming Minnesota residency and the right to vote in our Minnesota and local elections who has never lived in the United States but had a parent who lived here for at least 20 days immediately before they departed from the United States, doesn't say how long ago they departed. It could have been 30 years ago. To have them be able to claim residency in Minnesota to vote, and they've never lived here, is very troubling to me. I don't know how on earth we can describe them as residents. They've never lived here. But before, at least they would have had to have lived here for at least 20 days. But these have never lived here.
Mr. Secretary, do you want to respond, or Senator Erickson-Ropes?
Madam Chair, we're trying to come up with some examples to address Senator Roebling's questions, and I think Beth Frazier can address that, but I was just talking to,
General Consulter.
Mr. Consulter.
General.
General, that's General. Throwing me there. About a situation that perhaps if a family was stationed overseas, we have a lot of people who are military brats, if you will, and spend a lot of time, the kids grow up overseas and maybe, you know, come of age overseas, continue to live in Germany, and their parents, you know, don't live with their parents anymore. The parents originally had Minnesota residence and are Minnesota residents, even though they've been living outside the state for a long time. The child may have as well. And one example, well, that might be able to include some of those people. Ms. Frazier.
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, other examples are missionary families where the parents had lived here and have been overseas and raised their children overseas. Also, members of the State Department who are stationed overseas and have their children grow up overseas. Those are a couple examples. I don't know whether it was 2000, and I think it was 2004, there was actually a complaint in Hennepin County about a family where one of the parents was from Minnesota but married someone in Europe. They lived in Europe. Every summer they came over and spent the summer in Minnesota. And so the kids were here every year, and yet when they turned 18, they tried to vote and were not able to because our law did not allow for it. I don't think that it's accurate to describe these people as Minnesota residents. They are not. You're right. They have never been in the United States, lived in the United States or in Minnesota, but they are citizens of the United States, and I think they do have a right to vote in federal elections. This does not give them a right to vote in school board or even legislative or the gubernatorial election. It's just federal elections.
So if you look at lines 113 and 114, it's they can vote for president, vice president, senator, and member of Congress and nothing else.
But, Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling,
if you send them an absentee ballot, how do they know that they can't vote for everything?
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, we have different ballots that we send that just have the federal races.
And, Madam Chair, what have they done in the past, because we haven't had this before?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, they have not been able to vote. And my understanding is that Hennepin County, for example, gets about 20 calls every year from people who would fit this description and who are denied the right to vote, even for president.
So, Madam Chair, they're really U.S. citizens without a home.
Exactly.
But we're going by the fact that their parents have lived here at one time in their lives, we are going to say that this is their home. Mm-hmm. But it really isn't their home because they've never been residents here.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I believe that's true.
And
I would perhaps use my daughter as an example. When my husband and I were stationed in Guam, which is a U.S. protectorate, but it could have been Japan just as well, we were in the service, had our second daughter born on Guam. If we had continued to travel, she never would have had an opportunity to live in Minnesota. I've been born and raised here, and she would have been floating out in the global community without a Minnesota home, and yet I certainly would advocate for her to be able to vote somewhere for president, and it certainly makes sense to look at your parents' home, your grandparents' home state, and that sort of thing.
Is there further discussion on the Roebling Amendment to or motion to amend Senate File 1218 by deleting Section 1 of the Delete Everything Amendment? Senator Gimsey?
Well, Madam Chair, it seems to me also that what we could possibly do is have the federal government come up with a provision for these people to be able to vote rather than on a state-by-state basis based on only living here for 20 days, try to solve this problem.
Yeah.
I don't see how... Maybe I do have a question. How many other states allow this to happen with only being a resident 20 days and never, the kids actually never even being a resident?
And I would just add to that, Mr. Secretary, how many days do you have to live in Minnesota in order to be able to vote?
Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, there's 15 other states with this provision, and this provision was recommended to us by the federal government, meaning the Pentagon, and it's 20 days.
So anybody can be a vote in Minnesota elections if they live here for 20 days?
Madam Chair, if they meet all the other requirements, age,
citizen, and et cetera.
That's right.
So that's not extraordinary. I mean, the 20 days is not a new issue. Senator Gerlach?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Senator Roebling brings up a really good point, and I almost feel like the situation is people are caught in this limbo, but why is that our problem? Why is it Minnesota's problem? And when Ms. Fraser said that, well, they can vote for president, vice president, I can see that if you're a citizen of the United States but you don't have a residency in any state, why should you be disenfranchised from voting for president or vice president? And I can understand that because that's a national election. But you're also giving them the ability to vote for a representative of Minnesota in Congress, senator and Congress, and there is a distinction there. Now they are voting on representation for a place of which they are not residents of, and that is very bothersome to me. And I think Senator Gimsey was onto something there. Again, why is this our problem to fix here? It sounds like there should be some sort of special federal status and let them vote for a president or vice president, but not for representation for Minnesota. So I support the Roebling amendment to delete that section, and it certainly needs a lot more thought and study.
Mm-hmm. Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, it does seem to me that if you are a citizen of the United States and you just happen to be overseas for many, many years, you should have the right to petition a member of Congress of some state. You know, there should be some United States senator and some congressman that you can contact if you have a problem that is beyond, that is within their realm. And I don't know how, this raises a question, and I don't know the answer to, how do we assign when these ballots come in, how do we assign which county or which congressional district, you know, they're assigned to? I mean, if Hennepin County is contacted by somebody, I suppose that they figure, well, we issued the ballot, so it's ours. But I don't know. Where do you allocate them?
Mr. Secretary, it's easy to see the senator, but how do you know what representative in Congress they would be eligible to vote for in terms of the residence in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, if I could answer that. It's based upon the last residence of the parent.
Is there further discussion on Senator Roebling's motion to delete Section 1? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail, and the amendment is not adopted. We now have Senate File 1218 before us as amended. Is there further discussion? Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, I still have some concerns here, too. On page 2, lines 2.6 to 2.8, the fact that we are, you know, it just seems like I need to be given a scenario here of why somebody would not have one of these identification cards or numbers, passport number, license, now we're adding Minnesota driver's license or identification card, that they would not have something like that, and that now we're not, and so if they don't have any of that, we're not saying you have to go be identified by somebody else instead of just signing it yourself and saying, I am who I am. And I don't have any identification, but I am who I am. And I don't know. Anybody could get a hold of that ballot and do that and send it back in without identifying themselves. I'm really struggling with this part. And it's not just for military. It's for anybody. And I guess, you know, I have quite a bit of faith in our military people that they would not be fraudulent on this, but before we at least had somebody acknowledge who they were, they had somebody else sign this form if they had no identification.
Madam Chair, Colonel Allness is here to address
Colonel
that question.
Colonel Allness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Eric Allness, Department of Military Affairs. Just specifically about the reason why the Department of Defense wanted to shift from having a non-commissioned officer or a commissioned officer act as certifying and move to a self-certification is that, although it seems readily apparent in this group, overseas there is a lot of confusion about who actually had the authority and whether people, what were they signing up for. Also, there's some concern, too, going to a commissioned officer, would they in some way intimidate or influence what the voting of the individual was? So the Department of Defense made the recommendation that self-certification for military members would be more than sufficient to remove the perception of any intimidation, whether even though in most cases it was not intentional, or to remove the confusion that deployed service members were facing in that matter.
Is there a further discussion? Senator Larson then moves that Senate File 1218 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We now have Senate file 144 before us, and the corrections have, the technical corrections apparently have been made, and the Senator Erickson Robes, are you assured that these corrections or these changes were technical in nature?
Yes, I have been assured.
Mr. McGowan?
Madam Chair, it's purely technical. It has the same effect as Senator Erickson Robes' earlier version in about 50 less words.
thank you very much. So we have Senate File 144 before us. We had the discussion about the this provision for Winona County. Senator Larson moves adoption of the A4 amendment. Is there any discussion on that? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. We now have Senate File 144 before us as amended. Is there anyone who wishes to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 144 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam
Rose.
Chair, committee members.
Senator Lori, Senate File 1310. Senator Larson moves the adoption of the subcommittee report from the Subcommittee on Elections of Senate File 1310. Senator Lori, we went through this bill. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The committee report is adopted. Senator Lori, we went through this bill section by section. In the subcommittee report, would you just like to affirm that this is a bill that is technical in nature?
This is indeed a bill that is technical in nature.
With no policy changes.
No policy changes. We did go through it point by point. And, in fact, from its original introduction, I think we pulled 20 sections out of it. We pulled anything out that anybody thought there was any policy matter in. And it is a clean technical housekeeping bill for the Secretary of State. Willing to go through it if somebody would like.
Does anybody, any member, believe that it's necessary to go through these technical changes or have any questions about them? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify against or in favor of this bill or any of its provisions? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 1310 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Back to the committee again.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to take up the elections bill first, 758.
Okay. We have Senate File 758 before us. Go ahead and describe your bill.
Mr. Chairman, I move the subcommittee report
subcommittee.
On Senate File 758.
You move that report?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Senator Larson's not in the room.
Right. Senator Rust has moved the subcommittee report that Senate File 758 be recommended to pass.
No, just adopted.
Just adopted. Okay. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Senate File 758, what we clarify is that nonprofit organizations that currently need to report their expenditures for lobbying do not also have to report separately for lobbying for or against any ballot question before us at the legislature or elsewhere. And the issue is so that they're, at least in appearance, that their 501c3 or c4 status is not jeopardized or diminished. And that is some and substance of what the bill does. Across the political spectrum, nonprofits from the most liberal to the most conservative support this change. And so, Mr. Chairman, you can ask for testimony for or against this bill, and then I would then move the bill.
Yes. Does any members have any questions? Senator Betzold?
I don't often see retroactive effective dates. I'm just wondering what the effect of that
is.
The
point of that, Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzold, is that for this year, organizations which have been lobbying on ballot issues during this legislative session will not then, for calendar year 2007, like they did for 2006, have to make those two separate reports.
Senator Betzold.
Just curious, Mr. Chair, Senator Rust, is this kind of a, and I recognize it's an oversight in the law, but would anybody run into trouble if you know, the authorities say, well, this is a tacit admission, you shouldn't have been doing it before, like in 2006? So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's not Rust. A matter of doing the actual activity. It's okay. A matter of having, Senator Betzold, of having to make two reports.
Right.
And having to then establish a political action committee or political fund of some sort to do that lobbying. Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 758 be recommended to pass.
Is there anyone from the audience that would like to speak either for or against this bill? Senator Rust moves Senate File 758. Be recommended to pass. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, then, if I could go to back up to number 9.
Senate File 1597 is before us. And describe your bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1597 deals with the registration requirements and activities of the State Employee Combined Charities Campaign. And I have with me Mr. Jordahl from the Department of Employee Relations, which brought this bill to me to explain why it is necessary for us to, or why it is beneficial for us to make these changes in statute.
Welcome, Mr. Jordahl. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Rest. Yes, this indeed is our agency bill dealing with the Combined Charities Drive. The Combined Charities Drive is, I think, believe everyone probably in the room knows, is a payroll deduction program whereby state employees may direct charitable giving to charities that participate in the program. It's been in place since about 1991, and approximately 37 charities take part in the program. This legislation essentially streamlines the registration process and also does some cleanup with the statutory sites which oversee the program.
I'd also point out, Mr. Chairman, that it places the language in the moves it from the Office of the Attorney General with their recommendation into the chapter that deals with the Department of Employee Relations. And as that department gets eliminated, there will be movement into the appropriate state agency for that as well.
Thank you. I am informed by counsel that there are a couple of very small technical amendments we should make to this bill.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, these are just a few things I noticed while sitting here getting ready for this bill. On page 2, line 16, there's a phrase, the affiliated agencies which each devotes substantially all of its activities. I think I'd suggest there delete which each and insert each of which must devote.
So it would be strike which each devotes?
Yes, thank you.
The third word as well.
Yes.
And then insert?
Each of which must devote.
Mr. Chairman, I've moved that amendment.
Are there additional?
Yeah, there are a few more, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
On page 3, line 14, this is a little more stylistic. Delete whereby and insert that allows. And on the same line, delete may and insert to. So it would read the annual combined charities campaign means the annual state campaign that allows a state employee to authorize payroll deduction. And then finally, on page 3, line 24, delete will and insert must so that it reads an organization must apply in the form prescribed by the commissioner.
Is that the extent of the?
That's it, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I move those three provisions.
Senator Rust moves the three provisions suggested by counsel. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, that's the bill.
Would anybody from the audience care to speak either for or against this bill? Seeing none.
Mr. Chairman, I would then move that Senate File 1597 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 1597 as amended be recommended to pass. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Chairman, then I would ask us to take up Senate File 1755.
1755. Okay, present your bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File, what's the number here? 1755 allows a broader group of nonprofit organizations to participate in the joint powers purchasing agreements with the state, whereby they then are able to get goods and supplies at cheaper price. I don't know if there's, you can come and speak for it. I will tell you that the Department of Administration has some concerns with this bill being too broad, and I have some sympathy for their position. They're here. Yes, good, they're here. We'll hear from Mr. Allen in just a moment.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Byron Lair. I'm an employee of Greater Twin Cities United Way here in the Twin City area, and I'm here today at the request of the 39 different United Ways serving throughout Minnesota. Senate File 1755 would allow charitable organizations registered in Minnesota to participate in the state purchase plan. Some charities now do. The law was changed a few years ago to allow day training and habilitation providers, sometimes referred to as sheltered workshops, to participate, and it has worked well. Participants in the plan pay the state a fee, $500 currently, They're given a list of vendors with whom the state has negotiated prices on a variety of items. And if they're interested in purchasing those items, they contact the vendors, and they can buy them at the predetermined price. Adding charities in this manner would not cost the state any money. In fact, it might have a positive impact because each new organization would be paying the $500 fee to join. Now, we've discussed this proposal with the Department of Administration, and I have to say I'm surprised to hear that they have concerns, because when we left their office and drafted this bill, we were told they didn't.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Anybody have questions of this witness? Seeing none, I understand somebody from the Department of Administration would like to speak to this bill.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Good afternoon. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the director of the Materials Management Division in the Department of Administration. We do have some concerns about it. It's not really with the concept, and I think that's probably why there could be some miscommunication with respect to whether we thought this is okay when we chatted with the gentleman from the United Way. And it's entirely possible that he even took our advice in terms of suggesting that 471-59 be modified. But in doing that, we're actually defining certain charitable organizations as governmental units. And I think there could be some unintended consequences of adding more and more entities to the list of what we're defining as governmental units. And 471-59 is really designed to deal with government entities working together and addresses issues like liability limits, disbursement of public funds, joint issuance of bonds, incurring public debt, and none of those are really relevant to charitable organizations, but they would apply to them if they're defined in this section as governmental units. So what we thought is a much more direct way to address the same issue is to put some language in 16C, which is, in fact, the purchasing provisions in Minnesota state law. It's just moving from an indirect way of trying to bring some charitable organizations into this program to a much more direct way. And then the other concern that I'd expressed to Senator Rest is that in making all of the Chapter 309 charitable organizations eligible, you're bringing in a really, really broad group of entities. And I think it might be broader than what anyone would intend. I took a look at some of there. According to the Attorney General, there are about 7,500 who are currently registered with the AG. And I don't mean to disparage these organizations in any way, but I guess I would mention a few in the context of whether these are the sorts of groups that you really are intending to bring into the program. The Gopher Golf Booster Club, I Love a Parade Incorporated, the Marxist Educational Press, the Kent Herbeck Celebrity Tournament. And then in addition, there are any number of corporate and family foundations that are registered as well. And again, I'm sure these are outstanding organizations, but it raises the question of whether they should be buying off state contracts. Includes the Target Foundation, the National Distillers Distribution Foundation, the William and Nadine McGuire Family Foundation. So it's a very broad group of charitable organizations. So we've been looking for an alternative definition that would narrow that pool considerably and hopefully get to most of the organizations that you'd be interested in supporting. And the best solution that we came up with would be to use language that's already in our Chapter 16C at point 23, and it's the language that's been used to determine who's eligible for public surplus property. And the gist of this would say nonprofit organization includes the following, among others: Indian tribal government, any nonprofit and tax-exempt medical institution, hospital, clinic, health center, school system, college, university, or other institution organized and existing for any purpose authorized by federal law to accept surplus federal property. And that federal standard really looks at whether the program is serving what's considered a public purpose. We don't know exactly I do know that at this point there are 244 such organizations registered in Minnesota to receive surplus property, but that by no means would be the scope of those eligible. There could be many nonprofits and charitable organizations that haven't been interested in state surplus property that might very well be interested in purchasing off-state contracts and would be eligible under this existing category, which, as I said, we believed was probably closer to the intent and we think would cover the groups that Senator Rest and the rest of you would be interested in. We also were proposing that for clarifications purposes, the bill make it clear that when other states use our contracts, that the nonprofits in those states don't automatically qualify for this contract pricing, and it would be the laws of the individual states that would determine which entities within that state are eligible to purchase off public sector contracts. So those were the proposals that we had that we thought should get at the intent and make it more manageable and certainly a narrower focus of groups.
Senator Rust?
Mr. Chairman, those suggestions were made. I don't believe that a delete all amendment was drafted or that any amendment was drafted, but I did want the concerns to be heard, and then I would hope that we could speak with Mr. Lehr and get the issues resolved so that we actually allow what we want to allow and don't allow particularly things like charities in other states, et cetera. So, Mr. Chairman, I hope you'd lay this bill over. We'll put it on the agenda for Monday, and we will come to an agreement on what is a proper delete all amendment for this bill.
Senate files. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest, I don't think it'll be an issue, but something we should just double check on.
Okay.
The governmental units are subject to the Open Meeting Law and the Data Practices Act. Now, here it says on lines 12 and 13, governmental unit as used in this section includes. So I don't think it stretches to that point, but I don't think these charities want to be subject to the Open Meeting Law and to the Data Practices Act. So I think we maybe just need to double check that to make sure.
Mr. McGowan, would it be you that we would be working with on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, that's correct.
Okay, so you understand Senator Betzel's concern that so we would not get into that group of weeds.
Just off the top of my head, Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's a problem because governmental subdivision is well defined in the Open Meeting Law, so I don't think that would automatically pull in nonprofits, but I'll be verify that for sure.
Just to get clear, I guess the suggestion that Mr. Allen was putting forth would be to not define these as governmental units of government. Is that correct? And it would have – so, I mean, I share some concerns, actually, that if we define – if we – the mechanism we use to help them gain access to state contracting advantages – is to define them as governmental units, it might have some unintended consequences. So
Mr. Chair, you're right. We were proposing that the language be put in the purchasing section so that there wasn't any spillover into other areas that hadn't been fully thought through.
Okay. Well, with that, we will hope that the discussions regarding that go well, and we will lay Senate File 1755 over and take it up next week.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did want to lay the groundwork for it because I...
Yes. Thank you.
Motion. Mr. Chairman,
1759.
I now have Senate File 1509.
1509.
And, Mr. Chairman, I have a delete all amendment. Not a delete. I have an author's amendment.
Right. Okay.
The A1 amendment.
Senator Rust has an author's amendment, the A1, and moves this amendment. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what that did was just simply to bring the percentage of design-build contracts that the county would be permitted to do into line with what's permitted to for the state. So it would be no different. Mr. Chairman, I do have a... a committee summary or a summary of the bill. It's, this is a local bill for Hennepin County relating to the process of constructing buildings, roads, bridges, et cetera, through the design-build process. We granted the county, which is fairly unusual, but we granted the county the ability to do this a number of years ago for a couple of projects, which unfortunately didn't work out. So the process really because of those particular projects, the unique characteristics of them, it really didn't come to fulfillment. So we have come back, however, to look at them and to lift the restriction on those two demonstration projects, which did not work out, and to repeal the sunset date on the ability of the county to do this and to make some minor changes to definitions. The process that is discussed here is similar to the one that is required for the Department of Administration, MNSCU, and the Department of Transportation. Mr. Schreiber is here to representing the interests of the county to answer any questions that the members may have.
Do any members have any questions?
Mr. Chairman, then I would move that unless there's anybody else that wishes to
testify.
There's nobody in the room.
The audience?
to testify in the public. Yeah. I would move that Senate File 1509 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rust has moved Senate File 1509 be recommended to pass. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Senator Rust, any...
Chairman, I don't believe there's any further business before the committee.
Having no more business before the committee, it stands adjourned.